Horses Have a Different Color by Ralph Moody, University of Nebraska Press, 1968, Chapter 18, Making My Bid. I thank you, God, that I get to read as I look forward to this week when kids are coming home and we'll get to celebrate Christmas and the joy of Christ's birth, incarnation, the God become flesh. Thank you for that. Thank you for kids who believe the hope that we have in Christ. I thank you for grandchildren that they are growing up and hearing and learning and receiving the same good news. In Jesus' name, amen. The stock train on the main line was even shorter than the one on Christmas, and I was the only shipper to travel with the stock, so had the stockman's caboose to myself. Sunday was hot, but the short train made fast time and the stops were long. I refilled my barrels and wet my hogs 7 or 8 times, and doubt that any one of them drew a panting breath. I'd brought my butchering book along and spent most of the Saturday night rechecking my yield figures. They showed that if I could hold my overhead to 25% and livestock prices remained unchanged, there would be good profit in the contract at an across-the-board price of 15 cents a pound. Sunday morning, I began going over arguments I'd used to convince the commissary chief to award me the contract and his probable arguments against it. It became almost a game, and I spent every minute I wasn't lugging water and wetting hogs and carrying on both sides of imaginary arguments and dickering with the head of the CB&Q's commissary department. When the train pulled into Omaha Stockyards on 4th of July morning, my agent, Matt Quinlan, was there to meet it. He'd arranged for my hogs to be held over the holiday in shaded pens where there'd be a little breeze from the Missouri, and had a man on duty to feed and keep an eye on them. After we'd unloaded and penned the hogs, Matt walked back to the caboose with me, and as we talked, I fished my 2 glass jars and bucket of samples out of the icy water in the tub. He was naturally curious, so I told him the whole story, saying that I'd shipped my hogs to Omaha in hope of getting an interview with the head of the CB&Q commissary department. I couldn't have picked a better man to tell it to, for Matt knew all about the Q's method of handling meat contracts for their construction crews. He told me that the chief of commissary operations had his office in Chicago, and that the man to see in Omaha was Emmett Donovan, a neighbor of his, and that he'd get me an appointment for Tuesday morning. Matt wanted me to take the doubleheader ball game that afternoon, but I had to get myself some respectable clothes before the appointment, and I wanted to look around the secondhand equipment stores, so I told him I'd take a rain check until my next trip. When I shipped to Omaha, I'd always eaten in a little hole-in-the-wall restaurant near the depot, and the owner, Spyro Gusko, had become my friend. As soon as my hogs had been fed, I took my samples to the restaurant and asked Spyro if he'd keep them in his icebox for me until next morning. He sat with me while I ate breakfast, so of course I had to tell him what the samples were for. When I mentioned setting up a butcher shop, he became wildly excited, insisting that I must hire his brother Nick. According to Spyro, there was nothing in the world that Nick couldn't do except speak good English. Although he was careful not to say so, it was evident that Nick had come to this country to escape service in the Greek army. He'd served out his apprenticeship to one of the largest building contractors in the old country, but because he couldn't speak English, the only work he'd been able to get since coming to Omaha was in packing plants, and he'd been laid off when the livestock market collapsed. To calm Spyro, I said, "We'd talk more about it if I got the meat contract." After taking a room at the Stockman's Hotel, I set out to see what could be done with $20 to make me presentable for calling on Mr. Donovan. Most of the pawn shops in the Stockyards district were open, and I found some real good bargains. For $15, I got a pair of dress shoes, nearly new, a pair of gray wool pants that showed very little wear, a brown jacket that fitted pretty well on the shoulders, a white shirt, a bow tie, a pair of socks, a white handkerchief, and a stiff-brimmed straw hat. I found a tailor who lengthened the pant legs and jacket sleeves for $1, and on the way back to the hotel, I got a 2-bit haircut. When I'd taken a bath and changed clothes, I didn't look too bad in my city slicker outfit. I'd worn jeans, jumper, and brogans so long that I didn't feel comfortable in city clothes, so wore my new outfit only to go uptown and watch the 4th of July parade for half an hour. After I changed back, I set out to hunt secondhand fixtures where I could buy what I'd need for setting up a shop in case I got the meat contract. The secondhand stores were closed, but in nearly every window, there was a heavy-duty meat grinder powered by an electric window. A man could make as much meat sausage in an hour with one of those machines as he could make in a week with a hand grinder. But they'd be of no use to me because we had no electricity at Cedar Bluffs. My grinder would have to be powered by a gasoline engine requiring a tricky setup. To protect the meat from dust and flies, the grinder must be inside the house. And to protect the user from carbon monoxide fumes, the engine would have to be outside. It seemed to me that the best way to make the setup would be to run a drive shaft through the wall of the house, but it would have to be perfectly balanced and aligned to eliminate vibration. I couldn't do the job myself and didn't dare trust it to any blacksmith in Oberlin or McCook. What I needed was an expert machinist who had a well-equipped shop, but whose business was small enough that he'd take such a job at a reasonable price and do it in a reasonable time. I stumbled onto the right man for the job when taking a shortcut back to the hotel. His shop was in an alley, and except for a space at the front, it was crowded with secondhand machines of all sorts. Just inside the window, there was a metal lathe and workbench, and a man who looked to be in his late 60s was fitting a bearing to the drive wheel of a bandsaw. I stood watching him for maybe 5 minutes, but he was so absorbed in his careful scraping and fitting that he didn't notice me. During the war, I had worked as a carpenter and was mechanic enough to know an expert when I saw one, so went in to ask if he'd make me the grinding equipment I had in mind and what he'd charge for it. He didn't pay any attention to me or look up from the bearing until it fitted perfectly, and in the 15 minutes or so I stood waiting, I had a chance to do some thinking. If the temperature dropped to near zero when Bob and I were butchering, meat froze so stiff that it couldn't be cut with a knife, but it sawed like soft wood. It occurred to me that if carcasses were thoroughly chilled, a bandsaw would cut through meat and bones as easily as through knotty lumber. If so, it would speed up cutting steaks and chops as much as a power grinder would speed up sausage making. The only difficulty I could think of was that it would almost impossible to push a heavy piece of meat past the blade steadily enough to cut steaks of uniform thickness. That, I believed, could be overcome by a sled-like carrier with runners sliding back and forth in oiled grooves. But the piece would have to be moved forward each time and line up perfectly straight for the next cut. I was trying to figure out some way of moving and lining it up automatically when the old machinist demanded gruffly, "Well, what you kommt?" I told him that I might be going into the meat business in a place where there was no electricity, so would have to power my grinder with a gasoline engine outside the house. I just started explaining my idea for making the hookup by means of a drive shaft through the wall when the old German cut in. "Nein, nein, wer ist die Window? Wer ist die Window?" As he spoke, he stepped to the workbench, took a pad of yellow paper and pencil from one of the drawers and pushed them toward me. I marked out a rectangle to represent the east wall of the kitchen and drew diagonal lines from each corner to indicate sidewalls, floor, and ceiling. More to let him see my skill as a draftsman than for any reason, I sketched in a big icebox door at the center of the north wall, the back door near the left side of the east wall, and a window well to the right. In less than 2 minutes, that gruff old man made my sketching look like first grader's work. With a few deft strokes of the pencil, he drew the corner of the room, sketching the window with broken lines to indicate a transparent outer wall. Butted tightly into the corner, he drew a thick-topped workbench, with the front portion extending about 3 feet out through the window. Atop this outside shelf, he drew what was unmistakably the engine hood of a Model T Ford, with the crank handle hanging down at the front. Projecting below the shelf, he sketched the transmission housing, with the drive shaft extending under the bench to a gearbox 6 feet inside the room. As if suspended above the bench top, he drew a meat grinder head, also with a gearbox, from which a square shank extended downward. In English, so strongly spiced with German that I could hardly understand it, he explained that this would permit the grinder to be removed when not in use or set to discharge onto the bench or into a container on the floor. The controls for the rebuilt Ford engine, he told me, would be just outside the window so the speed could be regulated easily, the drive shaft disengaged, or its direction reversed. If the man had been less ingenious, I might have gone no further with the idea of slicing meat with a bandsaw. But I was almost certain he could work out a means of moving a large piece of meat past the blade in such a way that uniform slices could be cut semi-automatically. He agreed that a bandsaw would cut chilled meat and bone without difficulty if a fine tooth blade were used, and he liked the idea of a carriage mounted on runners, but could think of no way to move the meat up to the blade so as to make uniform slices. Neither could he give me a price on the grinder setup, but said he would have it for me the next afternoon and that he'd think more about the bandsaw problem in the meantime. I didn't go to Spyro's for supper, but stopped by the stockyards to make sure my hogs had been fed, listened to a band concert in the park for an hour or so, and went to bed early. From long habit, I woke at dawn and was in the stockyards by 4:30, but Matt Quinlan didn't show up until 6. He said he'd made me an 8 o'clock appointment with Mr. Donovan, but that he already had a 19-cent bid, including pork chops. While waiting for Matt, I had watched every carload of stock that arrived, but there were very few hogs, most of them heavyweights of only fair quality. Certain there would be a shortage of top-grade bacon hogs, I told Matt to hold mine back until the supply was exhausted. Then I set out for the hotel at a run. I shaved, took a bath, rigged myself out of my city clothes, and was at Spyro's restaurant by 7:30. The place was crowded, and Spyro was watching for me. I was barely inside when he rushed from the kitchen, yammering at me about hiring his brother Nick. To keep him quiet, I said, "Okay, Spyro, you let me fry some sausage in your kitchen, and I'll hire Nick if I get the contract." At 8:10, I set off for my appointment carrying a jar of raw sausage and a package of pork cutlets under one arm, a jar of shortening under the other, and a napkin-covered plate of hot sausage patties in my hands. The CB&Q building was little more than a block from the restaurant, and I had no trouble in finding the right office. The door was marked Commissary Department, and under it in small letters, Emmett F. Donovan. It was a rather large office with a dozen or more clerks, a wide aisle between two rows of desks, and a closed door at the far end of it. When I told the nearest clerk my name and that I had an 8 o'clock appointment with Mr. Donovan, he pointed a thumb over his shoulder and told me, "The door back there. Knock before you go in." When I knocked, a hearty voice called, "Come in!" I tucked the stiff brim of my hat under the plate to hold with one hand, but when I turned the doorknob with the other, the jar of shortening nearly slipped out from under my arm. I made a frantic grab to catch it, lurched against the door, and swung it wide open. A big, ruddy-faced man was sitting behind a desk at the center of the room, and there was a trace of brogue in the words when he sang out, "Have a care, lad. Looks like you've got both hands full and your britches to hold up." I knew instantly that I'd found a friend and a man with a good, solid common sense, so decided to lay my cards face up on the table right away. "I sure have," I told him as I slid the plate, package, and jars onto his desk. "But no other man ever had his hands so full and his pockets so empty. That's why I've come to see you instead of mailing in a bid. I'm dead broke and in debt up to my ears with neither a slaughterhouse nor a butcher shop, but I want the meat contract for the Beaver Valley job, and if you'll give me 10 minutes of your time, I'll bet you a hat you'll give me the contract." "I could lose the hat," he said. "Have a chair." I took the napkin off the plate, pushed it toward him, and said, "First, I'd like you to taste a bite of this sausage, if you will. It's the kind my mother used to make when I was a kid on the ranch, and our neighbors liked it better than any other kind. I didn't bring it here to try and fool you. There's some cow beef in it." He reached for the fork without much enthusiasm and told me, "A bit of pork chop. A pork helps canner cow hamburger, but I'm thinking that cow beef would ruin pork sausage." As he said it, he took off a scrap from a patty, put it into his mouth, and looked up at me with a surprised expression. "Not bad. Not bad at all, he said. "What's in it besides beef and pork?" Then he reached for a larger bite. Instead of answering, I told him I was the cattle trader at Cedar Bluffs, that one of McCook's butchers had told me he wasn't going to bid on the contract and why. "Matt Quinlan tells me you already had a bid of 19 cents, I said. "If the man who made it has a butcher shop near enough that washout to handle the fresh meat business, the chances are 10 to 1 that he buys livestock from me. At that price, I'll make you a bet that he aims to supply you meat from the cheapest old canner cows and worn-out brood sows I can find for him. Meat so tough and strong, you'd be ashamed to give it to your dog." Then I explained why I thought the job could be done far more economically by using good grade stock. "To get the contract, I'll shade the 19 cents price considerably," I said, "and guarantee to supply tender meat from young hogs and grass-fat heifers. But the contract will have to call for pork cutlets instead of chops, and for sausage per sample submitted. I'm gambling that the men will like this kind of sausage well enough to eat it at other meals than breakfast. If a quarter of the meat for the sauce job was sausage, and I supplied lard compound like this sample, I could use most of my fat back and beef trimmings and wouldn't have much left over to get rid of at giveaway prices. Mr. Donovan had sampled a third bite of sausage, reached for another as I was finishing, and told me, "This stuff is kind of like peanuts. It's easy to get, keep nibbling on, and I don't doubt the men would eat a spate of it. But lad, I can't give you that contract much as I'd like to. It's not that the wording couldn't be changed easy enough, and the good Lord knows I'd like to see the men get first-class meat instead of the junk the other bidders will deliver, but there's too many strikes against you. It's a fine kettle of fish I'd be in with the Home Office if ptomaine poisoning was to break out on a job where I'd let the meat contract to a lad with no experience, slaughterhouse, shop, or sanitary facilities of any kind. And what could you do with the contract if you got it? By your own word, you're dead broke, and to handle a deal as big as that Beaver Valley contract, a man will need at least $5,000 in ready cash along with a well-equipped shop. Don't forget that railroads pay only once a month, and on the 10th of the following month at that. If the job takes 500 pounds of meat a day, and I figure it will, a man could easily have $4,000 due him before he was paid a cent, and he'd need at least another $1,000 to keep plenty of butchering stock on hand. Sorry, lad, but even if you underbid the lowest established butcher by 2 or 3 cents a pound, I couldn't give you the contract. I grinned and said, "Now that you've told me why you can't risk giving me the contract, can I have 5 minutes to show you why you can't afford not to?" He grinned back and said, "6 if you want it, but it'll be a waste of time. I can't let my heart get in the way of my head on railroad business. That's why I think I'll get the contract," I told him. "My credit's fairly good out Beaver Valley way, so I can raise whatever cash is needed to handle the deal. But before making any bid, I'd like to remind you of something you may have overlooked. Being a livestock dealer, I know every butcher within 40 miles of that washout, and exactly what he has in the way of slaughterhouse, shop, refrigeration, and delivery equipment. Barring John Bivens at Oberlin, who isn't going to bid, the nearest established butcher will be 20 miles or more from the job. August and September are hot months out our way. The roads are in bad condition since the flood, and no butcher has a covered truck. Has the Q ever collected damages from a meat contractor due to a case of ptomaine poisoning?" Mr. Donovan had reached for another bite of sausage, but stopped with it midair and exclaimed, "Laux, don't even mention ptomaine. To feed a batch of bad meat to a big crew and you'd not get 50 cases. Before it was done with doctor's bills, lost time and all, it could run as high as $1,000. I grinned again and said, "That's all I want to know. Now I'll make my proposition. The place I lease adjoins the railroads right away at Cedar Bluffs, about as near the center of that construction site as a man can get. There's a good set of buildings on the place, including a vacant 5-room house that has just been renovated. If I'm awarded the contract today, these are the preparations I'll make by August 1st. I'll screen the house, put in running water, whatever equipment is needed to handle the business, hire a professional packing house butcher, and install an ice box as big and cold as any in western Kansas. In addition, I'll deposit $1,000 to be forfeited for failure to have adequate and sanitary facilities ready for operation by August 1st. Failure to complete the contract and for supplying as little as 1 pound of meat that is contaminated at the time of delivery. To avoid any possibility of ptomaine, I'll provide a covered vehicle and make 2 deliveries daily when requested. The price a man can reasonably bid on this contract and the quality of meat he can afford to deliver depend entirely on the amount of business he can be sure of every day and how near he can come to using entire carcasses of both pork and beef. If the contract is written to call for beefsteak, pork cutlets, and sausages per sample, I'd bid 17 and a half cents a pound straight across the board. But if lard compound is included and I'm guaranteed 4 months business at a minimum of $85 a day with payment in full at the end of every week, I'll cut my across the board price to 15 cents a pound. Mr. Donovan put a bite of sausage in his mouth and asked around it, "Want to give me a bank reference?" "Yes, sir," I told him. "I'll pay the toll charges if you'll phone C.L. Fricke, president of the Farmers National Bank at Oberlin. I'd appreciate it if you'd tell him which deal you're going to take. It will make considerable difference in the amount I'll have to borrow, and he'll want to know." "Who said I'd be taking either of them?" he asked, then chuckled and told me, "Don't rush me, lad. I've never run into a deal like the likes of this before, and I'll have to take the whole thing up with headquarters. If they'll go for the deal, there'll be have to be a special contract written up by the legal department. But there's no sense going into all that till I've talked to your banker. Write his name down on this pad for me, then get out of here and let me see what I can do for you. After I'd written the name, he reached across the desk, shook hands, and told me, I'll do the best I can. Come back at noonday, and I'll have the answer for you. I'll be here, I told him, and I'm grateful to you. Then I picked up the sample plate and got out of there. That is pretty cool how Ralph knows his numbers, knows how to talk to a supervisor and how to listen and pay attention so that he can lay out.